Hello and welcome to the Joy of Healthcare podcast, where we discuss how you can make a profit and put people at the center of everything you do. Today we have Chris Lee on the podcast. Chris is the CEO for the Colorado Visiting Nurses Association, which is the largest and oldest healthcare agency in the state of Colorado. Chris has taken an interesting path in healthcare, including stops in business development, hospital imaging, and mergers and acquisitions, all the way to CEO. Today, Chris will share with Jesse why you really don't want to buy a home health agency or start one, the importance of working directly with insurance companies, and why good partners are everything in healthcare. Thanks and enjoy the episode.
Today, I'm here with my friend and ex-colleague, Chris Lee, who is the CEO of the Visiting Nurses Association. Chris, do you want to start by just telling me a little bit about the VNA and kind of your role there?
Thanks, Jesse. It's great to be here and great to spend time with you. VNA, Visiting Nurse Association, we're generally nonprofits, organizations across the country. So there's VNAs in pretty much 43 states. There used to be three VNAs in the state of Colorado, all of us independent. There's no kind of national organization, so we're all on our own. We merged with one of those VNAs in March or May of 2016. This one in Denver, the one that I lead, we're the oldest in the state and one of the oldest in the country. We were founded in 1889, mostly focused on public health, so everything from senior wellness to hospice and palliative care. We're one of the largest home health providers in the state. We care for about 1,200 patients on any given day. And maybe about 130,000 visits a year. That's the biggest part of what we do. We also do paraprofessional support services. So we're the largest partner for Dr. Cog, which is the largest area agency on aging in the state. It's all founded and funded through the Older Americans Act, and we care for about 200 patients on any given day to really help them with light housekeeping and shopping and other things to keep them independent and out of facility-based care.
Great. So as the CEO of that organization, can you just give me an idea of, like, what does the CEO do? It sounds like a really fun and cool job. What's your typical day look like?
It is a very, very, every day is completely different. And it's a position like most CEO jobs of great stress and concern. We're focused really on the health of an organization, the ongoing focus of an organization. Does it have enough money coming in to be able to pay bills? But also being a CEO for a nonprofit, are we satisfying the mission? Are we caring for patients? Are we keeping them independent and in the home? How are we competing with other organizations? So we're also in the middle of selling our building. So we paid off our building, which is on Spear and Grant in Denver. So right next to 9 News, if you know Denver. And we're in the middle of closing on the sale of that tomorrow and moving into and purchasing another building in the suburbs. So that's all about deciding that we don't need to be in downtown Denver. We're going to be in a place that is a little easier to get to and leverage the size and scale of that building. So on any given day, it's meeting with staff and other leaders to make sure we have enough staffing to care for the 20 or 30 or 40 referrals we get a day. To signing documents on the sale of the building, to creating new partnerships or improving partnerships with our existing payers. We're the key partner for Kaiser Permanente in the state of Colorado, so we care for really about 500 or so of their patients a month or more. So really worked to partner with them to understand how we can create better value and really save healthcare costs and keep people out of the hospital when they don't need to be there.
Let's dig into partnerships, because I think this is really interesting on how do you choose which partners, and I guess specifically maybe those people who you don't already know, or maybe those aren't people that you engage with, but how do you pick working with one person or taking a meeting with one vendor or partner over another?
That is a huge question, and it's actually probably one of the most important questions that I think a CEO or a senior leadership team has to answer. And for us, I look for partners to be organizations that bear more risk ultimately for their patients, meaning it's great to have a partnership with an organization like United Healthcare, but the reality is they're spending other people's money in the sense that they're paid by companies and people to provide insurance. They don't care so much about the cost of healthcare, whereas Kaiser Permanente being our biggest partner, they are a payer as well as a provider. So they care about the cost of care, and they're interested in different ways to save costs. So I really look at new partnerships for organizations that are really interested in making healthcare better and are interested in thinking differently about where people get their care and how they get their care. So if I have a new partnership with an organization that is responsible for overall cost of care and patients, that makes it more interesting for me, and it provides me more opportunity to show improved saving costs. And therefore, I have a greater ability to benefit from a good quality and good cost efficiency as an organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I hear quite a bit is I want to start my own home health agency. So this is something I trip across a couple of times a year, is I meet a nurse or a PT or somebody and they say, I'm gonna start an agency, and we'll leave buying an agency on the table, because I think we could do a whole podcast about buying and selling agencies at this point with your experience. But what advice would you have for those people who think that they want to start a home health agency?
Don't do it.
That's good advice.
I will temper it by saying this: do it if you feel passionate about home health. If you're passionate about making things better, if you have seen different ways that people or other organizations are practicing, and you really feel like you have something else to add and something else to benefit patients, that's not being done. There are far easier and quicker ways to make money than to get into home health. We're talking about patients, and it's not something that we should be completely looking to profit from. We should be looking to help patients. It is a long road to get licensed to be a Medicare home health agency, and there is actually many states in the United States that there are no other licenses being given because there's been so many agencies started. Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy road. It's incredibly complex. There's a lot of consulting that you're going to need from organizations that help with the licensure and compliance and quality. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to it than that, but my advice is don't do it unless you feel really passionate about providing home-based care and you feel like you have something to add and improve.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. That at my small stint in home health, it's not that it isn't a highly profitable business. There is some profit to be made there, but if you're not in it for the right reasons, then...
There is some profit, but it is one of the most beleaguered. I wrote a blog post about this recently. It's one of those areas where the reimbursement is not going up for home health. In fact, it's going down year upon year on the Medicare side. Medicare really tries to incent and raise rates for areas that they want to improve or drive more volume to. So hospice has seen rate increases year over year. Home health, really over the past 5 to 10 years and into the future, is continuing to see lower and lower reimbursement. So if you're just trying to focus on making money in the Medicare space, yes, there's margin now, but that margin is getting less and less over time. And the reality is the cost of providing care is not going to go down. It's going to go up because cost of living is going to go up. Competition is going to go up. So, you know, you're looking at your major funding source, which in home health, the gold standard is Medicare fee-for-service. And the reimbursement for that's going down. And then there's also more move towards driving patients to Medicare Advantage, which is more managed Medicare. So it's, you know, when you're looking at getting into a business, you're not looking at a stream of revenue that's going to probably go up. It's going to go down in the future.
So along those lines, you've mentioned with your partners, you're looking for those people who have maybe a different lens on the fee-for-service or on the cost component. And then you're saying that in the future, you might see some changes. Where do you see the future of healthcare going? Do you see it going to alternate payment models or sticking in the fee-for-service world? What's your kind of prediction of what's going to happen with home health reimbursement?
Home health, I think, will be affected in the same way that other parts of healthcare is going to be affected. I think where I see healthcare going, and the reality is, take everything I say from where I think healthcare is going with a really small grain of salt, because no one truly knows. Certainly we have a very different administration now than we did a year and a half ago. And who knows where that's going to happen, what's going to happen with the next administration after that. But the reality is, no matter what, healthcare is going to be going towards more transparency, more payment for actual outcomes. and more ability for patients to actually understand where their dollars are going. So if you look at where what we get now when we pay for insurance, whether we pay for insurance through our employer, whether we pay for it on the exchange, every year we pay more for our insurance, but every year we get less for those dollars. So really what that means, that's completely and utterly unsustainable. So I see that changing, and the providers and the payers and the new insurance companies that in the what's being designed from Washington are going to be more focused on getting more for the value and more driving more and more waste out of the health system. So by definition, I really see that continuing to eliminate and decrease dramatically fee for service, and more move towards payment for outcomes, more move towards things like capitation, where you're getting paid, a health system or a payer is getting paid a flat per member per month to manage care. I see providers, whether that be home health or orthopedic surgeons, paid a flat rate to provide care for a period, and that's what you get paid. And if the cost goes up because that patient had an outcome, a bad outcome, they fell and went back to the hospital, well, it's on that provider, whether it's home health or orthopedic surgeon, to take care of that. And certain, therefore, the incentive is to not let that happen. So no matter what, and this is where starting a small home health agency becomes so difficult, scale will matter. The ability to prove the care that you're providing and have data to show that what you're providing provides value becomes more and more important. So no matter what, whether it's home health or orthopedics or imaging, it's going to be much more towards value.
Yeah, you mentioned waste in there. Where do you, in your opinion, where do you think we've got excess waste in the healthcare system? Maybe not just in home health, but just in general.
That's another really big question.
Putting your lean hat on.
And kind of thinking about waste, I think there's such a lot of waste in paperwork. There's a lot of waste in time, and there's a lot of waste in communication. So if you think about if you're... say you go to your doctor and you spend your 5 minutes with your doctor, and the doctor realizes, you know what, I don't like the sound of your lungs, so let's get a chest x-ray. And it's not Kaiser, say it's just a regular provider with Cigna or United or Anthem Insurance. Well, that information might get faxed, that order gets written, gets faxed to a medical imaging provider that's an outside imaging center. And then you go have your imaging done, and then that might be three days to a week later. And then the radiologist takes a day to 2 days to 3 days to read it. And then it gets back to the physician. And that then gets sent into a queue of 30 or 40 different results from lab and imaging and other types of providers. So you have all of this time just to answer a really simple question. Do you have pneumonia or some other issue? So the waste is all of that information flow back and forth in the time. And then if it's a week later that and you do have pneumonia, it would have been actually really good to have been on that antibiotic the next day or that day. So kind of you think about time waste, and the time waste creates the ability for that patient to get worse over time because of that waste and all of those extra steps. That's one example. I mean, another example is just doing more imaging. Like an example, low back. I used to run an imaging center in a hospital, so an MRI for lower back pain as being the lead thing ordered. Well, that, you know, who knows what the cost of that really is, and that's coming from someone who ran an imaging center in a hospital for 8 years.
Yeah.
But we'll just say that the actual cost is $1,200. Well, the reality is that MRI might show that you have some issues with your spine or your discs, and the reality is you may or may not have that fixed. Ultimately, what might happen is that they just prescribe PT. Well, what could have been done is actually prescribing PT in the first place and actually doing core exercises and save that $1,200. Mm-hmm. But we all know an MRI is not $1,200. It's really $3,000 to $4,000 or more.
Right.
So not starting with getting someone healthy with simple exercises, whether that's laying on your stomach and doing some yoga and some other strengthening, that in and of itself for many patients would have actually helped. So that's kind of two examples of overutilization of high-cost things when low-cost things would have been better, and time waste.
Do you see that there's... So in your first example of the exponential asynchronous communication, is there a role there for technology, or why... You know, we hear this all the time, but... that healthcare is behind the rest of the world, right? We can do all these really smart, fun things with our smartphones, but but for some reason we're still faxing back and forth results that take a week.
Yep.
where do you see technology, and why do you think that we're so complicated and far behind? It's a pretty loaded question.
So I have a couple answers. I think the absolute answer is yes. There are secure, easy ways to flow information really quickly. There's plenty of technologies out there that have been utilized by the banking systems for decades. Back in the 90s when I lived in Cleveland, I actually had access to my complete bank accounts online through the internet in the early 90s. And I could remove money back and forth and pay bills electronically without faxes. Here we are in 2017, I think it's 2017 still, where we are still faxing. A lot of my orders still get faxed. In fact, my biggest partner, Kaiser, my second biggest partner, the VA, we still communicate on orders and getting things signed via paper. We could utilize an electronic methodology, but that would require the physicians on the other end of the line to use something different that's not in the system they're utilizing regularly. So the ability to securely pass information from one system to another is a huge way for waste to be eliminated. And the reality is we're not always, or all of us are not all going to be on the same electronic medical record. Mm-hmm. There has to be much easier and simpler in ways of passing information from one medical record to another securely. That being able to do that would solve a lot of problems, would make things a lot cheaper, would make things a lot more secure. The reason why I think we're not doing that is risk aversion, and a lot of that I think comes from HIPAA, and a lot of that comes from really public hacking initiatives where hospitals and other medical providers have been hacked, and the hacking is more of a function of people in hospitals and health systems not taking the right amount of time and making the right investments to make things secure. Does that really answer the question? So it could probably go on and on.
No, I think it does. One of the other things, and I'm going to add my little tidbit here, is that I think the technology is out there and we have it, but adoption is really challenging, and we're so afraid to ask our providers to do one more thing because we've been asking them to do one more and one more, and we never take anything away. So it's, at least from where I sit in population health, one of the biggest challenges is not that the technology doesn't exist, it's that that's not the problem to be solved. The problem to be solved is implementing that technology in our current system without asking people to log into three or four different systems.
A physician or someone working physician has to see value. So implementing a piece of technology for the benefit of the system is not enough justification to twist a physician's or administrator's arm to use something. It has to take something away. It has to make their jobs easier. So yes, a physician is in it for patient care, but at the end of the day, they have far too many patients to care for on a daily basis to add time. Even seconds matter when it comes to a physician or a nurse or a therapist or any other clinician.
Right. Anyone who's going to be creating that bill, right? As far as I know, the providers are the only ones that generate revenue in healthcare. I'm going to pivot a little bit and ask you to share some of your organizational methods. Maybe that's the
secret sauce.
The secret sauce. Yes. How are you currently organizing electronic versus paper, or wherever you want to take that question in your current? I know it's a passion of yours.
Yeah.
On that.
So before running an imaging center at the hospital and a home health agency, I did work in IT, specifically in the radiology side. So I do have a level of understanding, enough to knowledge to be dangerous. But we are actually on our third electronic medical record. Every single one of my clinicians either has a 7-inch Wi-Fi or 3G or 4G enabled tablet or a smartphone. So all of the charting that we do is done on a small 7-inch tablet. We were one of the first agencies in the state to implement electronic medical record in the home health side. That was back in the 80s. I don't remember what that was called because I wasn't there then. And then we just implemented the one that we're on now, which is called Home Care Home Base, in 2012 and 2013. So the actual care that we provide is documented and is completely electronic. And we do have the ability to, when you ask me about the secret sauce for us is data. So we can report on every single piece and part of what we do, where my clinicians were from a GPS perspective, actually tracking signatures of patients to assure we're doing electronic visit verification for nurses, therapists, homemakers, personal care workers, nurse hospice nurses, et cetera. We've been doing that for almost a decade now. So the secret sauce really is being electronic. If we still have far too much paper in the building, so we're still printing stuff. However, all of my schedulers, the people who actually schedule clinicians to be in the home, and my admissions people, the people who process orders, we connect electronically now with all the hospitals that we receive patients from. So from SCL, for instance, if we get a referral from St. Joe's or Good Sam or Lutheran, we can actually pull that referral electronically. It's almost like an electronic fax, but at least it's electronic and it's actually not printing out. So we have the ability to input that electronically. We can send reports electronically. So those are kind of my perspective. There's a lot more to it than that, but I would say from a secret sauce, it really comes down to quality and being able to show and look where we need to improve. So, you know, on any given month, we have patients that readmit. So every single patient that readmits, we essentially will do a root cause analysis to understand what could be done differently. We know when that order came in. We know when we opened that patient. We can know what the key medications that patient's on, and we can see whether were we just treating the issue that we were asked to, or did we notice the indicators for CHF that were not on the order. And if we had noticed the CHF indicators, even though it wasn't mentioned, we could have reached out to that physician and asked for additional orders, for instance. So data really is the secret sauce.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you the question again in a different way, too. Because one of the things...
Does that mean I didn't answer right the first time?
No, it doesn't. You answered it very specifically. But one of the things that I'm still learning from you is the idea of an issue tracker. So you probably have a lot of people who report to you. Mm-hmm. I've got people that report to me. So keeping track of kind of who's doing what, I think you've got some good secret sauce there, too. So I'm gonna ask for some of that sauce.
That is a really big question. So we're an organization of $25 million in revenue and 460 employees across pretty much from South Denver to Fort Collins and Greeley. I'd love to say that I've got a secret sauce in terms of issue tracking and
you do.
Understanding what people do. A lot of it really comes down to dashboards. So we are in the middle of, and every day we're iterating on a dashboard across the entire organization. So everything from, you know, how many referrals we got, how many visits we did, how many opens we did, what is our compliance with starting patients within 48 or 24 hours or less, how much did we bill, how much cash did we receive, what is patient satisfaction. So we're looking at data and consolidating in a way that it's easy to see and track how we're doing really quickly, so that for an organization that's totally independent, that doesn't have a big brother that can bail us out, it means that we have very little room for error when it comes to billing and collecting and all of that. So, and we have very little room for error with our key partners, whether that be Kaiser, the VA, or others. So every single patient matters. So the way we track is really understanding how we're doing. Every single complaint or anything like that gets entered into our medical record and followed up on and reported on. We have our quality management team, and then that reports up to our professional advisory committee, which then reports up through our board. And all of that is then tracked and then driven by data. And that data is really where we really look at how we're doing on any given day, any given week, any given month, any given year. That's what we're doing today, where we want to go. I just, interestingly enough, saw that Google released all of their key processes across HR. So they're studying all of their managers. So every single manager at Google is reviewed twice a year anonymously by all of their staff. So the staff are asked, you know, did I have a one-on-one with my manager a couple times a month? Did that manager provide the scenario and the opportunity for me to do my best work? Did that manager remove roadblocks? And that information is not used for review, but it's actually used to provide information to that manager to get better, to support their employees. So
it's so funny that you say that, because I pulled that up yesterday.
Yeah.
So I was Googling yesterday about this new checklist.
Were you Googling Google?
I was Googling Google on the new checklist, but it's really funny that you brought that up, because I just printed that yesterday, which I think is funny. One of the other favorite things of mine to do, and I think it's yours because I always suck you into these conversations, is talking about new business ideas. Mm-hmm. So I can ask this in a couple different ways. I've asked you question number one before, if you were to start your own company, it doesn't have to be in healthcare, what would that company look like? Or do you have any business ideas that you might implement if you had three Chrises? If you could clone yourself.
So one of the things I find really interesting about my organization, this is a really early idea, which we haven't started yet, but we're actually thinking of investing in, is training. So one of the biggest things and one of the biggest ways that we, V&A in Colorado, attract employees to be in home health is the support and training that we provide them. Mm-hmm. So if you're a one-off small home health company, even if you're $3 million or less in revenue, you have very little flexibility and very little margin to be able to fund and provide training for new nurses and new therapists and new CNAs. We're big enough. We have, again, 460 employees. We have a clinical education staff of six. And when we bring on a nurse or a therapist, even if they're an experienced home health nurse, they have a pretty much a progression of training of over 3 months before they're expected to be at full stats, full productivity. They have extensive classroom training that we provide with our own people. And when they're done, when they're through all of that training, they are really well trained, really well supported. We've got basically eight quality nurses that review and look at charting and dig back into that staff member if there are challenges as part of that training. So I really feel like that education that we provide is a true differentiator that most other organizations aren't providing because they can't afford to.
Yeah.
So we really think there's an opportunity for our organizations to provide training for clinicians in a way outsourced through other agencies. So yes, there is a passionate business person who really wants to start a home health company because they just, that's what they want to do. That's in their DNA. It's an itch that they wanted to scratch forever and now they're in a position to. Well, that person has to provide good care for that person to grow their organization. Why not have V&A be their training organization so they have clinicians that have been really that V&A training around home-based care? So we feel like we're the best home health agency in the state from the perspective of training and assurance and support. Why not leverage that to kind of spread our overhead in a way to provide a business opportunity, but at the same time grow the amount of good organizations that are not V&A to provide care for patients in the home. And that's a way that we can serve the community, but at the same time build some mission, build some margin rather towards our mission. So that's something that we're kind of playing with. In fact, we have a small partner agency that helps us. They're census of 30 and floated the idea to him, and he loved the idea of being able to know that his clinicians were going to get the right amount of training so that he can sleep at night knowing that his nurse is going to provide the right care for his patients.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be interesting. Interesting to see how, if you guys diversify in that direction.
So that's one idea. There's several others. We have a grant right now called Capable. And it's a program that came out of Johns Hopkins, and it's a combination of OT, occupational therapy, nursing, and small home modification. And the idea through over a five-month program, 10 visits, and slight home modification is to identify proactive challenges and proactive needs of a patient around staying independent. So these are patients who are generally 65 and older, 200% of the federal poverty level and below, who couldn't really afford bringing in additional assistance, couldn't really afford to do home mod. So we're getting into the home, understanding what patients need, and really iterating on that. So far we've cared for seven patients. It's a partnership also with Metro Habitat and Metro Denver for the home mod. So we've got seven patients. We brought two through it. One patient was struggling getting in and out of the bath. One patient, same patient, was also struggling with pain. So we were able to make an alteration on that patient's tub so she wouldn't have to step as high to get in the tub to take a bath. We were able to understand that she had 8 out of 9 out of 10 on pain. And it wasn't something that she had communicated or had been part of her discussions with her physician. So we noticed that our nurse did, and were able to facilitate a conversation with the physician, get orders. We're able to decrease that patient's pain. So now that patient's now at 3 or 4, they're getting in and out of the shower and bath much easier. So therefore, much less chance of them falling. A second patient is a paraplegic, and he had a couple weird things where he was popping wheelies to get in and out of his doorway and almost gave my OT a heart attack when she saw it. So we worked with Habitat to come up with a different scenario to make that safer. Mm-hmm. He also really wanted to be able to share in the housework with his wife, because his wife's undergoing some other health issues. So we made a small alteration under the sink so that he could pull in with his wheelchair so we can wash dishes and really help in the housework. So it really helps the family overall stay independent. Mm-hmm. So that is a long lead-in to say that we feel that at Johns Hopkins, where this was created, they're saving almost $10,000 for each patient for a $3,400 investment. So we feel like, as I answered earlier, being able to partner with organizations at bear risk, we feel like this implementation really would self-help, would save healthcare costs in the sense that it's proactive care, not much money. It would delay the amount of time someone would take to spend down to be on Medicaid. It would delay the amount of time it would take for them to access their home modification benefit through the state of, through Medicaid, which is $10,000 or more. And it would save falls, which saves utilization on the ER side, and provides a much more view into the home for physicians who don't have enough time to be able to get into the home for the most part.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of a second business idea, and there's many, many others.
Great. As well. Sounds like you have a lot of really good stuff going on. Mm-hmm. If someone were to want to follow you or learn more about your organization, how might they get a hold of Chris?
The best way right now is through our website. So bnacolorado.org is the main website, and I have a blog. So bnacolorado.org/blog. Where I'm writing at least 1 to 2 blog posts a month. I've written extensively about partnerships in healthcare. I've written about the Capable program I just talked about and a couple other interesting topics as well. So that's the best way.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
Thanks, Jesse. Have a good one.
I hope you were able to take away some nuggets of wisdom for your own life out of my conversation today with Chris Lee. I would love to hear what you think of the podcast. If you have any feedback, if there's things that you think that we should talk more about or things that we should talk less about, please find us online at thejoyofhealthcare.com. And Lucas and I truly look forward to hearing from you.